My name is Jesse Hausler, and
I'm Craig Spooner.
And today we're going to discuss the universally designed learning experience and how to institutionalize universal design for learning at your institution or your university. What we're going to do today is first talk about what UDL is as we see it, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. We're going to discuss what happened in the past during our kind of initial attempts at getting this out there in our university, some lessons learned, and then we'll talk about the successes that we're seeing today.
And I'd like to ask at this point, I think we're going to assume that you know something about universal design for learning, and that's why you're here. Is that true? How many of you know about universal design for learning? Yeah, okay, most of you.
I guess who here, just to get an idea of who we're kind of speaking to today, how many of you here are administrators at your university? Mm-hmm. Great, about three or four?
Instructors?
Everybody. Double, great. How about IT personnel? Any of you work with like assistive technology or accessibility in particular? Great.
How about instructional designers? Oh, my goodness, okay.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for coming. That's a perfect diverse crowd that we were looking for today. So what we'll start off with a quick brief about what we are, who we are, and what we do. We are the Access Project at Colorado State University. We are funded by the U.S. Department of Education, Office of Postsecondary Education. Our grant was formed in 2006, and we are currently in the last year of our second round of funding. Our goal, and we'll probably both come back to this throughout the presentation, is to ensure that students with disabilities receive a quality high education. Okay, so how do we attempt to kind of reach this goal? Okay, now, this starts before the Access Project was formed. And mostly the same group of people. And what we did, welcome. What we did, our approach, was through the use of accessibility workshops that, discussed ideas such as course materials, web-based accessibility, course management, and so forth. And we kind of used more of like a stick approach where we discussed, compliance with guidelines, with regulations, Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, Section 508, and so on. And unfortunately, it didn't do a very good job of really gaining traction throughout our campus community. Has anybody else tried that approach and had similar results? I see some nodding. Yeah. So, and it doesn't work that way. We found that our focus was a little too narrow, focusing primarily on disability and assistive technology interactions. And we encountered a faculty perception that they do not have students in their classes with disabilities. If they don't see a wheelchair, if they don't see a walking cane, then it's not there. And a student with a disability doesn't exist. And those who did have students with disabilities felt that it really wasn't their job to do anything about it. There's a DS office, and their job is accommodations. They'll sort it out. I see a lot of nodding, so I'm assuming that's pretty widespread as well. I guess the last area where we feel that we kind of went wrong was that we did go alone. We did not develop many strategic partnerships throughout the campus community, and hence we were low on the list of administrative priorities. So when we put the proposal together for the Access Project, we knew that we needed to change our philosophy and our approach. We wanted to expand our reach to find a benefit for all students, and we wanted to look at disability as part of the range of diversity, and that an accommodation wasn't due to like a deficit in the student or the individual, but really a problem with the learning environment. So we wanted to focus on enabling the entire learning experience and the learning environment. We broaden the definition of the term accessible to really kind of pair accessibility and usability together. And we apply this. We wanted to apply these ideas to a wide range of technologies, including assistive technology. But the big one, the one that's really helped, was that we tied our goal, again, helping students with disabilities achieve this high-quality education, to those of the university. Okay, so these are, you know, this is five out of a much longer list of our university's goals. And if you could, just, you know, nod or raise if you know this is one of your institution's goals. Access, diversity, and internationalization, perhaps. Enhancing accessibility for students with, you know, directly enhancing this idea for students with disabilities. Increasing active and experiential learning opportunities. Perhaps not as many nods. Increasing student engagement. And the big one, I'm sure everybody, increasing retention and graduation rates. Okay. So by aligning our goal with these goals, we knew that we would be much higher profile and we'd get a lot more buy-in from the university. Okay, so the big question is, how do we do that? And since you already saw the cover slide, you already know the answer. But I'm going to let Craig tell you what that is.
Thanks, Jesse. At the Access Project, our definition of universal design follows the one developed by CAST. It's a three-part model, which we'll go into some more detail about. And our working definition is a set of principles and techniques for creating inclusive instruction and accessible course materials. And just to kind of make this a little bit easier for people to get their head around, we're really kind of talking about teaching and technology, really maybe two sides of the same coin, making the environment itself, as Jesse said, more inclusive, more accessible, as well as all of the materials of instruction. And here are those three principles developed by CAST. This is a model that was developed for education. It came out of educational theory as opposed to the classic universal design model that really grew out of architecture and a kind of a different paradigm. And in this case, we're looking at multiple means of representation, getting students engaged in multiple ways and expressing their comprehension in multiple ways. And these three pieces are what I'd like to just kind of go into in a little bit more detail now.
Jesse, I'm just thinking with the video, I need to do it. Did you hear that?
What I'd like to do is show you three very quick clips of our own faculty at Colorado State University and students talking about universal design for learning as it relates to them, how they're experiencing it and the benefits of it. And we'll start with the first principle of multiple means of representation.
I believe that one of the goals of good teaching is to try and reach every student in the class, not just the A best students. And I think a lot of traditional lecture courses may be geared towards students who do well at listening to a lecture and then repeating that information on examinations or using that information on examinations.
To me, teaching is all about communication and maximizing the student's experience so that anything new I can bring to the table might apply and stick to some of the things they already know. So for me, I'm trying to get real clear on how students process information and learn, and I know that they learn it different ways.
The thing I like about universal design for learning is that it maximizes student learning by increasing the numbers of ways that students get to see information. And I think that more students can be reached when you use many alternatives to traditional lecture. So, pull out our clickers.
When we talk about student diversity, we also need to consider students with disabilities.
At CSU, we have approximately 750 students that have identified themselves as having a disability. Of these, roughly 75% have a learning disability. The number of students with non-apparent disabilities may in actuality be higher, because the students either may not understand their disability or may even be reluctant to come forward and ask for assistance. Students with disabilities can be found in every discipline and every major.
Universal design principles help us reach and engage more students, both in and outside the classroom. It's not surprising, therefore, that instructional technologies are another important element of UDL, and one issue of particular importance is the development of web materials that everyone can use.
By adhering to well-established guidelines for web accessibility, our web content becomes easier for everyone to access. Information can be easily translated into a variety of formats. Students with disabilities benefit, but so do users of older technology and those using the latest portable devices.
With the ever-increasing role of technology in education, it is imperative that our instructional materials be accessible to all. As a public institution, we're obligated to do this by law, but it's also just the right thing to do.
So, representation, the first principle, multiple means of representation, and you heard in the video Dr. Suchman illustrating with examples of ways that she can convey information to students or have them discover information that go beyond traditional lecture. And you saw the iClickers, which we'll talk again about when we talk about engagement. iClicker is the brand, although I haven't seen them here at this conference, but they're the one that we settled on a couple of years ago as a standard for the campus.
They are here.
Uh-huh. I figured they would be. So group activities, hands-on exercises, and then new media, graphics, audio, video, as well as text. Certainly that's appropriate these days for our generation of students, but also just as a addressing all of these multiple modalities. And as we heard in that clip, also course materials that are accessible that everyone can use. So we call those universally designed documents that combine usability and accessibility so that everyone benefits. Let's take a look at the second principle of UDL, expression.
I've come to learn that students learn best three ways, and I call it the three P's, through projects, performances, and some kind of presentations. And I try to get away from lecturing and dumping information to them and give short lectures, asking them to come together and co-teach each other, to practice something, to draw me a picture of what I just taught, to find another way that taps into the many ways we process information.
They like the fact that there are opportunities to show what they know outside of traditional examinations, that they can do group examinations, that they can do problem solving, and that they can show their knowledge in alternative methods to traditional examinations.
So much of our learning is recall. I give it to you, you give it back to me, but it's not very deep. And that's why I've got to find ways for you to present it or somehow build a project around it or perform it some way, because then it's a much deeper learning. I know you've worn it and it's going to stay with you much longer. When that happens, I mean, students light up, and that's the reward that I get in teaching.
Expression. As Dr. Feller described, his phrase is projects, performances, and presentations, which I think is an apt way of describing active expression and synthesis on the part of the students in terms of making the information their own. Writing examples, journals, kind of a long writing project, portfolios, in-class writing assignments, very often mini writing assignments are very popular right now. In fact, in the research that I'll be describing in a little bit, concurrently with our research, there was also a project that involved a lot of in-class writing, and we believe we saw some significant improvements in engagement because of that. Other kinds of media, new media, like we talked about for instructors in terms of representation, the same applies to students, allowing students to express their comprehension using alternatives to a written paper. In many cases, artwork, videos, film art would be, these days particularly, the modes of expression of choice. And finally, engagement, engaging in multiple ways.
So I try to plan before a class and say, how do I break this class into sections? I can give some information. I want to practice some information. I want to draw something. I want to see a visual cue. I want somebody to stand up and teach somebody. I want them to draw a picture of what we just covered. It's about me planning ahead enough to accommodate the different ways people learn, because if I only teach the way I learn, I'm going to miss too many people.
UDL also promotes active learning.
In my class, I do a lot of active learning. I really like more of an interaction and less of just me talking. But with a group this large, if I ask them questions and I ask them to raise their hands, no one wants to do it. And so, because no one wants to be the person who's wrong with their hand up. So the thing I like about the clickers is that I get students to answer questions, which gives me immediate feedback about where their level of understanding is, and then I know if I need to talk about a topic again.
One of the most effective ways to engage students is by sharing our enthusiasm for the topic we're asking them to learn.
I think that when professors are excited about the material, it just kind of spreads to the students, and they get excited about it. And especially when the professor shows how the material really applies to real-world situations.
Okay, so engaging students in multiple ways begins with things as simple as expressing instructor expressing enthusiasm for a topic, which might be hard to dredge up in some cases, but I think we all know that it's an essential component of an engaging learning experience for students. Other things that are well-known best practices in education: giving prompt and instructive feedback, challenging students with meaningful real-world assignments. These have been known and proven to be effective for years, as well as some of the newer technologies like adding clickers to a classroom to not only liven up and add participation to a lecture, but also provide feedback for the instructor. So these practices that I'm describing and that you've seen in the video, if you have been in education for any length of time, you'll recognize them as long-standing good practices. What's new isn't so much the teaching practices as the framework itself, this three-part UDL framework that describes good teaching and effective learning. And so here are three principles: multiple means of representation, expression, and engagement, coming together to create a conceptual model that actually has proven to be very effective with faculty as a professional development conceptual model. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, now that I guess we're all on the same page with UDL, I guess I'd first ask, does anybody have or understand it UDL in a different way or have some different ideas about UDL and how that would work? Great. Okay. I'll use that.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get to the meat now. Actually, the institutionalization of Universal Design for Learning. So it's a four-part plan. And, you know, one of the main goals with this plan is to have this institutionalization remain after our project funding ends. So we want something that is sustainable. Okay, so the first part here is dissemination, followed by the creation of an award for UDL implementation, the formation of an advisory group with campus administrators, and then these strategic partnerships that we didn't make the first time around. We'll hit each of these kind of in their own turn. Okay, so at Colorado State, what we've been doing as far as dissemination is trying to, instead of having our own standalone presentations, which we do, but more importantly, we're trying to embed these UDL principles into already existing professional development. And to give you an example, there is a computer training series that happens every semester for faculty, for staff as well, and for graduate student assistants and TAs, that teaches them, you know, basic things like Microsoft Word and Outlook and some web coding using Dreamweaver, PDFs, and so forth. And what we do is we work with those instructors to not just put a UDL section at the end or an accessibility section at the bottom or on a side note on their documents, but actually within that presentation, have it part of it, have it flow like it should, because it does belong there. Regionally, we're very active in what's called the Colorado-Wyoming Disability Consortium for 2 and 4 year institutes of higher education. And this is a really good opportunity for really everybody in that consortium to share ideas, to that's about it. And it's a good place to bounce, you know, kind of ideas off of each other, to get new, to learn new and kind of, you know, medias, new ways to engage students and so forth. So that's a very useful tool. And is also, you know, we disseminate nationally and throughout the region at other conferences like EDUCAUSE. You know, building on this idea that we take something that's already in place and kind of leverage that to kind of implement UDL, what we've done is there's currently an award on our campus, or there was currently an award, called the Preston Davis Award for Instructional Innovation. And what we were able to do was get UDL as a category for that award. So it's already a well-known award that's sought after by, you know, faculty. And by associating, you know, UDL on that award, we're not only doing that, but we're associating UDL with instructional innovation. We're promoting the use of UDL while providing a monetary incentive. Okay, the third and one of the more important aspects of this plan was the creation of an advisory group. So we have an advisory group that currently has 3 vice provosts sit on this board, the director from our Institute of Teaching and Learning, as well as vice presidents from Student Affairs, Central Computing, and our retention offices. The VP of Central Computing, and he's actually now the Dean of the Library, was the narrator in our video. And so if you're thinking, well, how am I supposed to get vice provosts, vice presidents, directors, and so forth to sit on a board? You know, it really starts with one administrator. And in our case, we initially asked, it was Dr. Pat Burns, who was the VP of Central Computing, to, you know, read over our proposal when we submitted for the Access Project's first round of funding. And then we later said, you know what, you should be a co-PI and work with us on this grant. And he accepted that offer, and he took his role very seriously. And through him, we were able to open the door to all of these other administrators throughout the campus. So if you can find one person, then it can open the door to many other people, representatives on your campus. Okay. So how does this help? Well, you know, the benefits are huge. One, we get advice. Advice from, you know, very experienced and external perspectives. Not just the same people bouncing ideas off of each other, but, you know, we're getting project directions from, you know, people who've been in the industry, who've seen, you know, failures, have seen successes, and know what works. We have the opportunity, again, as I mentioned earlier, to tie UDL to the institution's goals, as well as reminding them of the benefits of UDL. And we have credibility because we're working with this group of administrators, as well as access. So we have buy-in really all the way to the top of the university, the top levels, you know, which gives us introduction to these professional development venues, such as the one I mentioned before, kind of embedding our ideas into those tech modules and those tech sessions. And again, in the same way, it helps us develop partnerships. So we're really kind of seeing this top-down approach as well as this bottom-up. So we're working with with campus administrators, while we're also influencing what, you know, grad student TAs are learning. And then the last step are these strategic partnerships. And I'll talk briefly about these 4 that we have. One is with the Institute for Learning and Teaching on our campus. This has become, you know, very big in recent years, which I think is a good thing. And again, this door opened because the director of that program sits on our board. Central Computing, our library system, as well as some individual academic departments. So very briefly, I mean, these are a list of five areas that are partnership with the Institute for Learning and Teaching open to us, but I'll discuss this top one here, the Provost Course Redesign Initiative. Right now on our campus, there's this initiative that the Provost Office is offering, I think it's up to $15,000 per department or per faculty, to completely redesign their 100 and 200 level courses, because those are the main sources of, you know, lost retention and lost graduation rates. A lot of these kind of gateway courses, you know, huge lecture halls, 200-300 people, where students can really feel lost in such an environment like that. So we're working with that and some of these other kind of workshops and institutes. Through central computing, I mentioned before these technology workshops that we influence. We're also working with the people who manage and do the training for our content management system, our course management system. It's currently WebCT. Laugh. It's okay. And you know, we're working. You know, we've worked with them on developing online modules for best practice, as well as the kind of in-classroom training sessions. So even these kind of like online course management pages for your classes, they're universally designed, so we can get them to be consistent from course to course and so forth. We are, because WebCT is, you know, kind of dead now and, you know, end of life, we're working with the people who are evaluating the new course management system. And when that is selected, we're absolutely going to be working with the people who will be doing the training and writing the modules for the next CMS. And that's going to be a very good opportunity for us, because with the current one, we kind of got in, you know, late, because, you know, everybody had their way, their courses are made, they know how to use it, they're happy with it. But with the new CMS, we're really going to be able to catch a much larger crowd. Working with our libraries, we've assisted them in kind of making universally designed electronic reserves. Does anybody here have any e-reserve system still, or is everything through a CMS? A few. So right now, we have both. You know, we have an e-reserve system through our library, but we also have just faculty posting things through, you know, WebCT. But, you know, this has really helped us so that every kind of e-reserve that does go through the library is now, you know, what we call universally designed. It's searchable. It's, you can copy and paste from it. You can use text-to-speech for it, and so these are all things that benefit really everybody, is, again, as well as students with disabilities.
I might mention that these are PDFs specifically we're talking about.
Yeah, PDFs. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then electronic books is really the new craze, and our library is working with a way to, you know, get rid of our stacks, or at least that's Craig's fear. You know. And so during that, we're also involved in that project, working with the planning team, you know, for this kind of e-book reading technology. And in this case, it's actually a collaboration between our university and the city's public school system. So we're even kind of branching out there as well. And then finally, we are training faculty kind of, you know, face-to-face. We've gone into the psychology department and met with their group of teaching fellows, faculty who are interested in learning new ways to teach and kind of engage their students, as well as a group from our veterinary sciences school. So we're teaching them face-to-face, and we offer these online modules in technology, UDL ideas here, and obviously those are free to everybody to access. Is that URL still that one?
Yes, it's
correct.
It's good.
Okay. And, you know, working in these, in the departments themselves, really gives us an opportunity to do some research. And, you know, UDL research is kind of, isn't very broad right now, but, you know, we're helping to change that in these gateway courses. And Craig is going to talk to you a little bit more about some of the research that we're able to do because of these relationships.
Yes, thanks. When we began approximately 5 years ago, we realized, well, a couple of things kind of simultaneously. One was that to really get the buy-in that we wanted to achieve this institutionalization that we're talking about today, we realized we really needed some research to back up what we were claiming about UDL and its effect, its impact, its benefits. And at the same time, we also realized that as much as UDL was being talked about out there, in the literature, however much there was 5 years ago, not really all that much, but certainly online and numerous organizations and universities were publishing information and guidelines. So there's a lot of information, but very little concrete evidence to back up some of these claims of effectiveness, very little empirical data. And so we realized that that's probably what we needed to do, was to contribute to the literature and do some studies of our own. And so we set out then to do some research, and we came up with four goals. The primary goal was examining the effectiveness of instructor training. We knew we were going to create some professional development for faculty and graduate students, as it turned out, but for instructors generally. And to measure the impact of that, we needed some kind of a pre and post test, some survey that we could give. And we decided to give it to both the instructors themselves and their students through a kind of a preliminary process of identifying where we would do this research. We settled on psychology, Psych 100, where we had approximately 1,500 students per semester that we could survey. And we did that over three semesters. And in addition to determining the effectiveness of this UDL training, we also wanted to get from students what they thought contributed to an effective learning environment, what helped them to learn. So what created an effective learning environment, and what practices helped them to learn. And we also wanted to know how many students were we talking about. As Jesse said, often instructors would say, I don't think I have students with disabilities. I don't really know if this pertains to me. Well, we wanted to put that to the test. And so we asked students to self-identify. The question was, do you have a disability? And we didn't really ask them to elaborate on that. But we did follow up that question with, have you sought accommodations through our disability services office? And all of this was intended to lay the groundwork for some research toward monitoring persistence and retention, one of those strategic goals that Jesse mentioned. So some of our results. In terms of quantitative data, we saw that that after the training, their students perceived an increase in the amount of information that was presented in multiple formats. Well, we were pleased to see that, because that's one of the core principles of Universal Design for Learning, presenting information in multiple ways and in a variety of formats. And students said, yes, I'm seeing more formats happening here. Instructor actively engages students in learning. Again, another core principle of UDL, and we saw an increase, a statistically significant increase. And then we saw kind of a cluster of responses of significant increases in things that seem to have to do with setting the learning in context, explaining to students, for example, key concepts, relating them to the larger objectives of the course, making that link explicit to the students. Beginning class with an outline, something very simple, but almost universally, instructors said, you know, I'm not really sure I do that. And probably it had just simply to do with a limitation of time. They were trying to cover a lot of material. Summarizing key points and doing the same for instructional videos, really trying to drive home what the point was. What am I showing this to you for? What are you supposed to take away from that? We also got some qualitative data back, some open-ended questions on our survey. And in terms of increasing student engagement, students said iClickers were very engaging. They found that
technique, when used well in class, really got them interested and perked them up in class. And in fact, I can testify, having witnessed that on several occasions, that a huge room of hundreds of students would you know, students would be eagerly waiting to click in their answer, which is very different from just, you know, just simply listening passively, unfortunately, as I'm having you do right now. But interestingly, the next biggest strategy that increased engagement was simply asking questions, period, regardless of whether there was technology used or not. So as an instructional designer, I'm always kind of delighted when you can find a low-tech solution to something as well as a neat, cool, high-tech one. And just asking questions, getting some Q&A happening is engaging. Videos, you probably won't be surprised that students, young students, found that very engaging. And I'll just jump down now to the next category, strategies to increase and support learning. Well, videos, again, big surprise, huh? Providing examples, I think asking questions, providing examples, they're both something that, in the second case, they're providing examples, puts it in context again. It kind of goes back to what we saw on the last slide. iClicker questions, PowerPoint, specifically the structure and organization of slides or note pages distributed to class before or after class. And just finally, checking for understanding. Checking in, do students get it? And I think that, you know, kind of connects with the clicker questions as well. So the third goal that we set out to investigate was corroborating the national statistical data about students with disabilities. And in fact, we did. We found that among the students we polled, 9 to 11% reported having a disability. And depending upon your source, the Center for National Education Statistics is currently reporting, I think, 11.3% of undergraduates say they have a disability. And we found between 9 and 11%. Nationwide, we're talking about more than 2 million students. So, as you heard in the video, we see this occurrence spanning all of the different disciplines. It's not, you know, related to one major or one college or one, you know, academic area over another. It's well distributed. And finally, we felt that we had statistically significant evidence that just a few hours of training definitely produced some benefits, some increased behavior that corresponds to this conceptual model that we talked about for good teaching practices. These are practices that helped all students. I think one of the keys that helps make this project and this the effort really work for students with disabilities is that we're doing something that benefits all students, whether or not they have a disability. And we found that since these are generally acknowledged best practices, that's what it does. And just to conclude before we take your questions, we experienced a philosophical shift. Our project actually grew out of this philosophical shift involving universal design for learning, which focused on creating a more accessible, a more inclusive learning environment, as well as the materials of instruction, making sure that those were usable by everyone. Creating this multi-tiered dissemination plan and promoting it using this existing award that also has $1,000 attached to it, by the way, which is another nice little incentive. Getting the advisory group that, as Jesse said, allows us to kind of gives us reach into the campus community in a way that we really couldn't have done from the sidelines without their support. And of course, how we did that was tying it to the university goals. I mean, that for them is the bottom line. What are we trying to do? We're trying to increase diversity. We're trying to increase engagement and ultimately persistence and retention. And I think we've shown to them that these are that the UDL principles and the practices that follow from them do have that kind of impact. And finally, doing UDL research to help validate our claims of efficacy. These are, in a nutshell, kind of, this is our approach as we head into our final year of funding. It seems to have produced some good results, but I realize, we both realize that all institutions are different, and I think we'd like to really hear from you about how this may or may not work at your institution, or what kinds of changes might be required. So please, let's have a little conversation about that. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Our university actually does have a very large distance education center right now, and a lot of the principles are the same. Most of our online learning is done through the use of like either a Panopto or a MediaSite type lecture, and we promote some of the same ideas that we would in classes. So when somebody does have a lecture online, we ask them to include the captions for that, for instance, because you know those captions, while they can help somebody with a disability who might be have a hearing deficit, it would also help students with English as a second language, or perhaps the professor has English as a second language, and it would help all the students better understand the concepts, and so on. And there's also some there's another example, the guy who actually won our UDL award this past year, an example we mentioned, that he places online in his courses when a student in the actual physical setting has a question. This is a physics professor. Has a question that they'll come in to his office hours and say, here's my question, professor. And he said, that question is amazing. He pulls out a video camera and he hands it to the student and says, ask me again, but film me this time. And I'm going to go and I'm going to write on the board and show you the answer to that. So what he'll do is he'll put that online for the entire campus, or the entire class community to understand. And by adding captions and transcript to that, you truly do make it a universally designed kind of addition to your course materials. Does that help answer?
Yeah, and I'm also wondering about getting them, engaging them in, like showing a PowerPoint can be kind of very passive. Are there strategies for engaging students?
In online.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now a big, maybe I'd answer this better, I know the idea with, especially like in our business school, a lot of our online courses are very asynchronous. So if somebody's in, Saudi Arabia taking a class, they're viewing it at night, whereas people that are in person are obviously doing it, at a different time. So a lot of the engagement really happens through these discussion forums, but it's still in an asynchronous manner. Is there anything?
I would like to add, can you hear me?
That actually sound pretty good.
For some reason, it actually sounds amplified, and yet, but maybe you can't even hear me back here. One thing for sure to increase engagement is really kind of trying to break up those PowerPoints or videos. If it's distance, it's probably in some kind of a video format. Breaking them up with activities, with some checks for understanding or something like that. Unfortunately, we haven't, and this might have been part of your question, we haven't actually focused any of our research on online courses per se. So I don't really have any figures to share with you there, but I do think that these three principles really apply almost equally to an online course, really allowing students to express their understanding in different ways certainly can be done online as well as in the class. Engagement can happen usually through other techniques if it's not face to face, but through Jesse and I both attended a kind of a session on games, and I'm not sure I really that big an advocate for gaming, but I do see that it's very engaging. Certainly, students find it so, and or even some kind of any kind of activity that requires some kind of synthesis and evaluation of that. That's something that could break that up and you know, make it more engaging. Or asking students to relate it to something that they care about. Yes.
Your advisory group is a good idea. It sounds like you've got a good high level representation on that. My experience with groups like that in the past is the agenda tends to peter out. Mm. You know, you run out of agenda topics, people lose enthusiasm. How is the agenda being driven for that group, and what's on the agenda?
Well, I mean, we meet with them twice a year. And, you know, our team develops the agenda, and what we try to do is not load it too much. So there is lots of time for opportunity to discuss and get some of their ideas. And it's mostly, you know, us asking them questions. What do you think about this, and what do you think about that? We also have a rotating position on the advisory group to get, you know, fresh ideas as well. I think with the current one is a former Department of Occupational Therapy, which brings in a very good perspective on like rehabilitation sciences and so forth. Did that help?
So what some of the gender items do you have? Yeah.
Well, currently, I think one aspect of our project is something we didn't talk about today. It's self-advocacy. And it's a piece that actually kind of hasn't had as many resources and time given to it to develop. And so at our last meeting, I think we spent a lot of time exploring with them how we could, or ways in which we could tie this into existing activities. And it goes back to, Jesse mentioned the VP for engagement. We have several different departments, the Center for Academic Advising and Student Advising, or whatever that stands for.
Yeah.
And key communities and things like that. So currently, what's on the agenda is ways to tie in with some of those courses that they teach and workshops.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of partnerships. You know, who do you know in this area? You know, we'd like to, because again, having the director of our teaching and learning, we say, you know, what initiatives are going on right now that we can tap into? And he says, oh, this person, and you know, here's who you should talk to about that, and I'll contact them as well. It's mostly things like that. And we also show them our research, give them updates on that as well, and they'll ask us and maybe suggest some different directions and so forth.
I think you raise a very good point, though. I can definitely see that happening. We haven't reached that point yet, but you know, as we, you know, kind of achieve the things that we set out to do, it may become harder and harder to really kind of get them enthused about our agenda.
Yeah. Anything else? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's very much.